Dude, Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you can find him at restaurants, grocery stores, and farmers markets. And with some know-how, care, and patience, you can also grow mushrooms right at home. A Wisconsin mushroom expert tells us how to get started. First, two big election polls came out this week, and they both had very different results. The Marquette University Law School's latest poll showed Governor Scott Walker with a one-point lead over Democrat Tony Evers. But just yesterday, an NBC Marist poll showed Evers up by 10 points over Walker in a head-to-head matchup, an 8-point lead with third-party candidates included. So what do we do when we see two polls with two drastically different results? Harry Enten is a senior writer and analyst for CNN Politics and our go-to guy on polling. Harry, welcome back.
My pleasure to be back.
So when you see, Harry, the same race, day or so apart in a poll and a big difference like that, what do you start digging into to see why they might be so far apart?
Well, I think number one, what I'll point out is obviously all these polls have margins of error, right? So when I see two results that are different, I don't necessarily panic. I say, okay, maybe something, it's just a statistical noise. But then I dig a little deeper and I say to myself, okay, if it's not statistical noise, what might be causing this? And in this case, there is one major difference between the two polls, and that is that Marquette weighted by education levels and Marist didn't. And one of the beliefs that we have of why the polls got everything wrong in the Midwest in 2016 was there weren't enough non-college educated white voters in them. And, of course, those voters tend to be more Republican, and since Marquette did weight by education, it could be that they are weighting up those non-college-educated whites that Marist simply isn't. And it's possible, certainly not saying that it's definite, but it's possible that's why Marquette chose a lower total for Tony Evers versus Walker and why Marquette may be a little closer to the truth.
So pollsters are looking at the demographics of the people that they reach in the random surveys and saying, okay, there's that, and how does it compare to the realistic demographic breakdown of people who actually vote? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's really what pollsters are trying to do at the end of the day, is in order for a poll to be as accurate of a representation of the voting population as possible, it has to look like it, right? And so there are a bunch of different variables that different pollsters will look at to say, okay, we don't have enough whites without college degrees, or we don't have enough African Americans, oh, our sample is too old or it's too young. Demographic variables like those traditionally are the variables that most pollsters weight off of. But in this particular case, Marist weights off of income and Marquette weights off of education, and that may potentially be causing this difference in the result. I'm certainly not saying it's all of it. In fact, it might not be most of it, but it's probably a decent portion of it.
I understand a lot of polls use different definitions of what a likely voter is when they're doing a likely voter poll. Marquette's based on voters certain to vote, as they define that. Marist uses a different model. How do different polls define how likely a person is to vote and whether or not to include them in that poll?
Yeah, I mean, you just hit on two of the differences right there. You know, there are some people who use a cutoff model, which is essentially you're definite to vote, and if you're not, goodbye, we're not including you. There are some that try and weight respondents by their different probabilities of weighting. So that's traditionally, I call that the CBS model, where every single person's response gets included, but some people's responses are weighted up more than others. I should point out that that was probably not the cause of why these two polls differed. Among registered voters, forget likely voters, and you look at Marist, you see that in the Marist poll, when third-party candidates were included, Evers was up by 7, and you look at the Marquette poll among registered voters, and Walker was actually up by 4. So that doesn't seem to be what's causing the difference here, though it is certainly the case that sometimes it's the likely voter screen that does make the difference.
Talking to Harry Enten from CNN, looking at what happens, how we should read it when we see two polls in the same race showing very different results, as we see this week in the race for Wisconsin governor. Harry, something that people argue about a lot, I think anytime a poll comes up, and this is, I know from your Twitter feed, this is something that comes up for you a lot, is the partisan representation. How many Republicans, how many Democrats show up in the sample? How do you handle that?
Well, it really depends, and I think that there are two differences in terms of party affiliation that I should point out. In Wisconsin, there is no party registration, right? Everyone's unaffiliated. So there's nothing really to weight off of in terms of that. That party registration is something that's very different than asking someone in a poll, are you feeling closer to the Democrats right now or closer to the Republicans? I don't like waiting off of that question because that can change, right? Someone may one day feel like they're closer to the Democrats and the next day feel like they're closer to the Republicans. But waiting off of party registration, if it were available in Wisconsin, I think that that could be something that's more solid because we have a solid case of that from a Secretary of State, say, like in the state of New York where I am right now, we have party registration. I would say in Wisconsin, it could be the case that you could perhaps wait off of what was the last party primary they voted in. Neither of these pollsters do that, but that's a potential possibility. But overall, when you're asking a question of, oh, am I a Democrat or Republican, or how do I feel today, that's an attitude. That's not something that most reputable pollsters would wait off of.
Now, there's another set of polls that I don't get to see. I don't know if you ever get to see them, the internal polls that campaigns or parties do. There are rumors, at least among conservative-leaning people in Wisconsin, that their polls, their internal polls, are showing closer to the Marquette poll, a really tight race, than this big Evers lead. Do we ever get a sneak peek behind the curtains at those internal polls?
We do occasionally. You know, campaigns or the campaign committees, the Democratic committees, the Republican committees, may release those internal polls. I should point out, though, that those tend to be unreliable, not because we're saying that they're waiting them to try and make people think something other than is actually the truth, but there tends to be a selective release of them so that Republicans will only release the polls that look good for Republicans and the Democrats will only release the polls that look good for Democrats. So we're not actually getting a random sampling. Obviously that there are some people, you know, like the Cook Political Report or Inside Elections, which are two Washington, D.C.-based firms, who will sometimes get fed that insider information. That helps feed their sort of viewpoints of the races. But usually most in the public don't get to see those. And the few times that they do, those it's not necessarily an accurate representation.
Right. It seems like sometimes you'll see that poll. I'm a candidate. I'm 1 point behind, and I'm releasing that in my fundraising appeals to say, hey, this is the time to give you some money. We're close, but we're falling behind.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, there's a lot of interesting political science around whether or not you would rather show yourself slightly behind or slightly ahead. I believe it actually shows that if you're trying to raise money, you want to be just slightly behind, you know, and we need your money to catch up now. And a lot of campaigns use that, and often quite effectively.
Now, you and a lot of other political watchers out there are trying to do something even more complicated than figure out one race. You're trying to figure out what's going to happen overall in the Senate. So that's like a third of the Senate seats. What's going to happen overall in the House? So you've got all these individual races and how they feed into that. How are you trying to wrangle all those cats?
Well, you know, the fact is we have a great new website up at CNN right now, cnn.com/forecast. And essentially what we do is we take a look at all the polling data. We take a look at fundamentals such as, you know, how the district or state voted in the past, how much money has been raised by the candidates, as well as also those race ratings that I mentioned to you earlier that are created by those who might have an insight into what the internal polls are saying. And we basically add all of those up across races, and we see how accurate they've been at this point in predicting the actual outcome. And then we try to correctly model the error to say, okay, we believe that this outcome is most likely overall, but it could be as good as this or as bad as this for the Democrats and Republicans.
What is, as of today, the most likely outcome in either House?
In the House of Representatives, the most likely outcome is that Democrats take control, according to the estimate that we have, with 229 seats. But they may fall well short of that with only 205. Of course, you need 218 to control the House. And then in the Senate, we think that Republicans will actually pick up a seat. They're at 51 now. We think they'll pick up a seat and go to 52. But again, there's an outside shot that Democrats could, in fact, get control. But that's looking like a true outside shot at this time.
All right, Harry, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Harry Enten, senior writer and analyst at CNN Politics, talking to us about how to make sense of poll results when those results are drastically different from one another in the same race. How great would it be to have fresh mushrooms at home whenever we want them? Maybe the classic white buttons or shiitakes, criminis, or a whole bunch of others. Well, if you've got some patience and don't mind a little work, you can grow them yourself. In fact, our guest says it's really not much more difficult than growing a tomato. You just need a little bit different skill set. Tavis Lynch is a commercial mushroom forager and cultivator in Cumberland near Rice Lake. He's a certified mushroom expert by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and vice president of the Shiitake Growers Association. He's the author of Mushroom Cultivation, an illustrated guide to growing your own mushrooms at home. Tavis, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, before we talk about growing our own mushrooms, let's talk about you. What got you fascinated by the world of mushrooms?
It's just been a lifelong hobby that turned into a little bit more than a hobby. I've been picking mushrooms since I was a kid and picking them up and studying them and wondering what they were.
And when did you first start growing your own mushrooms?
I played around with it about 10 or 15 years ago and then got to a commercial level about 2010.
And looking at your book, a lot of mushroom growing is outside. I'm going to ask what might be a stupid question. When I moved into a rental house one time, there were mushrooms growing in the basement. I did not eat them. But it makes me wonder, can we grow edible mushrooms indoors, or is this strictly an outside gig?
It can definitely be done indoors. I've grown them as a little bouquet in the center of my kitchen table before. It doesn't take up very much space. It's very easy, and they can grow indoors or outdoors. Obviously, we have a limited season here in Wisconsin for outdoors. So, yeah, indoors is just fine.
So if somebody wants to try growing mushrooms at home, indoors or out, what are the first steps they need to take to figure out how to do it?
The first thing you have to do is decide what kind of a mushroom you want to grow. Some of them will grow really well on wood. Some of them will grow really well on straw. Some of them will only grow on your compost heap. So choose a mushroom that you like to eat or one that you think is pretty to look at, and then start looking at the ingredients you would need to grow that mushroom, how available there are in your area.
Now, I heard somewhere you are into wine cap mushrooms lately. That's not a mushroom I think I'm familiar with. Tell us about that one.
That's a European mushroom that can be found now nationwide as kind of an escapee, but it's a super easy mushroom to grow. I started growing that one in 2010. It's very fast growing, very high yielding. We can grow that mushroom in as little as like 5 weeks after we, and I use quotation marks here, plant them.
Yeah, why quote marks? It's not exactly planting like we would a plant. We're working with spores here.
We're actually working with spawn or mycelium, the organism itself, the fungus, not the reproductive cells. We've got them already spread out into a medium, such as sawdust or grain or a couple of other holding mediums. We're adding that to a larger medium and letting that colonize that. So with wine caps, we grow them on straw, and what we're adding is the spawn mixed with sawdust to that straw.
Now, if I wanted to get some mushroom spawn, I wouldn't know where to go. Well, where do we go to buy the basic materials we need, the basic sources for our mushrooms?
If you have a little bit of laboratory knowledge, you can certainly build your own at home, but there are some fantastic companies. One right here in Wisconsin, Field and Forest Products over in Peshtigo, and they are the best in the business.
And we'll talk about the range. How many different kinds of mushrooms can a beginner find at a place like that and get started with at home?
Oh, dozens. Lots of choices. They've got a catalog that's kind of fun to look through, as do all the spawn suppliers. So, yeah, your choices are not limited. There's plenty of choices. If you like the white buttons, you can grow the white buttons at home. They're actually a little more difficult than, say, a wine cap or an oyster or a shiitake.
So shiitakes are more expensive at the store. I know it seems like they're fewer and far between, so that seems like a great one to try to grow at home. Save some money and grow a really fancy one.
Well, absolutely. And you can do it on a large scale, or you can buy a small kit that you can grow right on your kitchen counter. It only takes up about a square foot, and you can get fresh shiitake mushrooms in just a matter of days.
And you mentioned the different kinds of mediums, wood, straw, things like that. What do shiitakes like to grow in?
Exclusively wood or sawdust blocks. They press them into like a loaf of bread is what it looks like.
Huh. Now, for that outdoor arrangement, you've got some cool-looking ones. A great pictures in your book, by the way. Talk about what kind of wood you're working with when you grow mushrooms in that on those racks outside.
Well, if I could grow them on white oak all the time, I would, but it's not always available. People don't like me just going in their yard and cutting down their white oak. But I do have, I've had great success with ironwood, hophorn beam. So that's been my primary wood source for the last probably 4 years now, and it's proving to be very productive and easy to find, and it's always straight, and it's always 5 inches in diameter. It's very nice to work with.
And what different kinds of mushrooms can we grow on that? The shiitakes we already mentioned.
Shiitake will grow on ironwood, as will horicium, which is commonly known as bear's head or sometimes lion's mane. If we want some other mushrooms, if we're going to try to grow oysters, box elder or aspen are good weed trees to use for those. So you can actually thin out a forest, improve the health of your land, and while we're removing that wood, we can use that to grow mushrooms.
Talking to mushroom expert Tavis Lynch from Cumberland. He's the author of Mushroom Cultivation, an illustrated guide to growing your own mushrooms at home. If, by the way, on the off chance you are a mushroom grower yourself, we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us about it, or if you need some advice from Tavis, why we'd love to take your question as well at 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. Tavis, you mentioned that compost. I have a compost bin out back. I could take some of that out. What kind of mushrooms can I grow on compost?
One that grows really well is our common store-bought mushroom, the white button, but anything in that genus of Agaricus. We've got some beautifully scented almond mushrooms also in that genus. They grow really well in compost. One of the more common woodland mushrooms that we have here, the bluet, which you can find in the wild, they're out right now, they also do really well in compost.
And is that last one we could buy from a store or from those suppliers you mentioned, or would we have to harvest or forage it ourselves?
Well, you'd have to forage it or grow it. That's not one you're going to find available at any stores.
And how weather sensitive are mushrooms? What kind of extremes can they take during the normal growing season?
Well, extreme heat does have a tendency to do some damage. Obviously, extreme cold will too. I almost called in yesterday when we were talking about all the rain and how it's affected farmers to say it's great for mushroom farmers.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I've had an extremely successful year due to the excessive rain. So that type of an extreme is definitely helpful. Drought, on the other hand, is a lot more difficult to handle.
And talk a little bit now about cooking mushrooms. I know you've got some recipes in your book. What are some of your favorite ways to consume the mushrooms you grow?
You know, I'm not a very good cook. I fry everything I have in butter, and it's just fine. Those recipes were supplied by chefs of restaurants that I sell mushrooms to. So I leave that end to them.
You know, but I honestly, what you just said is my favorite way to eat mushrooms, too. Fried in butter, a little salt and pepper. You don't need to get very fancy, do you?
No, if you want to taste the mushroom, I say keep it simple.
And so this time of year, obviously, it's getting cold. We're not going to start planting our outside mushrooms now. When do you get started in the, I don't know, late winter, spring? When do you get started with the next year crop of mushrooms?
You could start right now, but there's always that risk of frost and freezing that, you know, October and November are very unpredictable here. I drove through a snowstorm last night up near Ashland. But we usually start harvesting the wood in January and February when it's alive and dormant. And then we start inoculating that wood in early April.
I want to bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Three Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm curious. I've been heating with wood for over 30 years. So I have, I put it in the same spot. I cut it in the same spot. And I have, it's mainly oak and maple, more maple probably than oak. But what can I grow on that?
He's got maple and oak firewood. What kind of mushrooms could he grow on there?
Oak is a great host for shiitake, as is maple. Now, if it's sugar maple, it's a superior host for shiitake. If it's red maple or silver maple or box elder, it works, but it decays very quickly, and we don't get a lot of production. If you're doing it as a hobby, fine. It works great. If you're doing it on a commercial level, you're kind of wasting energy there. But yeah, shiitake would grow both on both of those. And actually, maple's almost the universal host. You can grow a very wide array of mushrooms on maple.
All right, good luck to you, Mark. We'll go next to Donald in Iron River. Donald, hello.
Hi. Hey, you talked about that company in Peshtigo. Is there a phone number or address I can get from you?
Yeah, their website is fieldforest.net.
Fieldforest.net. So that'd be the place to find that info, Donald, and good luck. Liz joins us now in Viroqua. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What's your story?
One of the few good things about this rainy summer is I have an oyster mushroom log, and it's producing beautifully right now because I haven't had to water it.
Okay, and have you been growing a long time, or are you just figuring it out on your own, Liz?
No, yeah, I tried once, and I put the first log too far down in the woods, and I forgot about it. And this one I put under a shrub where I can see it from my kitchen window. So I took better care of it.
That sounds great, Liz. Oyster mushrooms did well. And so, yeah, in a less wet season than we had, Tavis, are we just watering our mushrooms from time to time?
Exactly. And we don't want to water them every day. If they were to stay wet all the time, we would have problems with other invading fungi or microorganisms finding a way in through that wet bark. But they do require about an inch of rain every 10 days.
We got that this year some. Liz, thanks a lot for calling. And Tavis, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Tavis Lynch is a commercial mushroom forager and cultivator in Cumberland. We talked with him about his book. It's called Mushroom Cultivation, an Illustrated Guide to Growing Your Own Mushrooms at Home. Fish can be an intimidating food to cook, for me anyway. Between picking the right kind of fish, knowing how to pick quality seafood, and figuring out what to do with it, fish is seemingly not an easy meat to serve. But don't worry. On this week's Food Friday, our guest is here to share some tips and recipes that will take the fear out of cooking seafood. Joe Guerrera is the author of Joe Knows Fish, Taking the Intimidation Out of Seafood. He's the owner of Citarella Market in New York City. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. How are you?
Well, I'm good. Now, I read the introduction to your book, and I thought, you're talking to me here, because I love to cook. I cook a lot. I am scared of fish. I think I'm going to blow a lot of money. I'm going to overcook it and ruin it. I am your target audience. Is that right?
Well, you know, I really wanted to name the book Taking the Intimidation Out of Cooking Seafood, but my project manager, my writer, my PR gal, my assistant, my wife, they all ixnayed it. And they said the name was too long, but I really wanted to name it that because I think, you know, that's the hook, taking the intimidation out of cooking seafood. But they ixnayed me, they overruled me, and they named it Joe Knows Fish.
Now, why do you think fish got this reputation as being difficult to cook?
Because there's a couple of reasons. Number one, it's a lot more. Much more delicate of a thing to cook. It's not like, you know, throwing a steak on a barbecue or throwing chicken on the or grilling a pork chop or something like that. It's much more delicate. And I think the delicateness, and because it's delicate, it takes a lot less time to cook. And people just have to give it the effort and the tender, loving care to cook it. And that's what this book's about.
You write at one point that, if you're going to cook fish, timing is the key. You've got to watch the time. This is not a food you can walk away from or text or whatever, watch a video.
Your cell phone or cell phone. You just can't do it because, you know, you can be, if you're sauteing something, some items could be a minute or a minute and a half on each side, no more than that. And, I talk about even poaching shrimp. You know, you throw it into boiling. You throw it into boiling water for 2 minutes. That's it. That's it. No, nothing else. I guarantee you, 75% of everybody overcooks shrimp. I guarantee it.
Now, I'm here in the Midwest. We got a lot of great local freshwater fish, but I'm standing about as far from an ocean as you can get, I think. So, and I don't know from quality seafood. How do I know if I'm out trying to buy some, you know, saltwater fish? How do I know what to look for to make sure it's fresh? It's going to be the best stuff I can get.
Well, listen, I can't help you there. I could give you a real estate broker in New York if you want. You're thinking of moving, but what I really would do is just recommend that you'd have to trust your fishmonger. One of the things that the best way that I could describe when you're looking at seafood is it's just as if you have a regular TV, or you have an HD TV, or your computer screen is regular or HD. That's how a fresh fish should look. That's sharp. The lines, everything should be really sharp.
I like that. That tells me what to look for. Now, you talk about, just while we're on fish quality, we've heard this thing, sushi-grade fish. And you're right, that's not exactly a thing. What does that mean?
Sushi-grade, if you see it someplace, what it really means is that it's fresh, and you can eat it raw. I could honestly tell you that, because certain fish you can't eat raw because of its texture, or can't be sliced, like a flounder cannot be sliced for sushi. A fluke can, but a flounder cannot, and a cod cannot. But everything that we at Citarella sell, I would eat off the counter in a heartbeat. It doesn't matter what it is. So everything that we sell is sushi grade.
Talking to Joe Guerrera, author of Joe Knows Fish, Taking the Intimidation Out of Cooking Seafood. He's owner of Citarella Restaurant in New York. You gave us a couple recipes. We have these online at WPR.org/Food Friday. I want to get into this one. I love it. It looks easy. Poached wild striped bass with tomato and garlic. First, what do you like about striped bass for this recipe?
Well, you know, striped bass is one of the, I guess it's probably the poster fish of the East Coast. It's very popular in all restaurants. It's plentiful, and it's hearty. It's sort of like the grouper of Florida. It's the striped bass of the North.
And then you want to poach this one. Tell us how we do that.
Well, it's really simple. You know, you just put a quarter inch of water in a pan. And depending on the thickness, because the striped bass has a size limitation, so they can't be small. So the fillets have to be a little thicker. So if to poach it, it might take you 5 to 8 minutes, depending on the thickness of the fish. And it's really quite good. You'd be very surprised that, you know, it could really take you a few minutes. All the fish, all the recipes here, it'll take 5-6 minutes, depending, especially with striped bass, on its thickness because of the size. But even if you're poaching a salmon or poaching other items, it's a few minutes. You could eat a meal in 5 minutes. You're ready to eat. That's what's so great about it.
And this seems like a theme in your book, as I look at a lot of recipes. Pretty easy and pretty clean, I guess might be the word. You want to taste the fish and not cover it up with lots of other stuff.
Oh, that's what I do. That's what I am. And it's healthy eating. It's really, really healthy. You know, it's sort of like, you know, this is me, but not you know, people, if they want to go on a diet, have a salad, but don't have a Caesar salad. You know what I mean? So it's a similar thing. But the book starts, I did it in a way where it's very simple for people. If you look at the table of contents, it starts with grilling, which I feel is the easiest thing. And then I go to baking and roasting, and then broiling and sauteing, and then poaching, then frying. And each category will get a little bit more complicated. Well, not complicated, but it's a little bit more, it requires a little bit more effort to do. But I started the first chapter is grilling, which everyone can grill a steak. So you can just grill a piece of tuna or grill a piece of salmon or swordfish. That's the format of the book.
Talking to Joe Guerrera on this week's edition of Food Friday. His new book is Joe Knows Fish, taking the intimidation out of seafood. He's the owner of Citarella Market in New York City. He is, like the title says, helping us cook fish. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about cooking, preparing fish? What do you want to know about choosing fish? Or if you have a favorite way to cook seafood, chime in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR if you're looking for a recommendation for, Badger game, Brewers game, Packers game. We got all of them coming up this weekend. Joe might have an idea for you. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Right now it's Food Friday, and we're talking about fish and easy ways to choose, prepare, and serve seafood. Our guest is Joe Guerrera. He's the author of Joe Knows Fish, Taking the Intimidation Out of Seafood. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about seafood? What tips do you have about preparing fish? And what are some of your favorite recipes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Becky is with us in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hey, we do a lot of fishing on the freshwater lakes around Wisconsin. As you know, they're plentiful, and we like the pan fish, and we normally do a grill or a fry, but I wonder if your guest has any ideas or does like to do any sort of soups or chowders.
Becky, thanks. A fish soup or chowder with some of our freshwater fish in Wisconsin, Joe.
I'm sure you can do it. I think, what did you say? You normally grill it or fry it?
Grill or fry, she said, yeah.
Have you ever baked it or sauteed it?
We've done it all. Yeah, we've done it all. But I do like a seafood chowder. And I was, could you recommend some kind of seafood that we could use for a chowder?
Well, I'm not that familiar with all the fish in the Great Lakes. I'm familiar with walleye. I'm familiar with carp. I'm familiar with whitefish, and some perch. But I think you have a lot of other varieties that do not reach New York that I don't see that you get them there locally. I believe, isn't that correct?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
See, we don't. What would be? So let's get back to your question.
Yes.
I would assume that you could definitely make a chowder from it. I don't see why you wouldn't. You know, of course you'd need the bones to make a stock.
Sure.
And tell me the types of fish that you're talking about.
Well, we do usually crappie, bluegill, some walleye, perch, and I throw the fish in then in the last couple of minutes of cooking the chowder.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the fat content of the items that you're referring to. I'd have to look into it a little bit more before I could answer. Because you don't want fish that are too fatty. You don't want fish that's too fatty. Like, you can't use salmon to make a chowder because it'll be too greasy.
Okay. Well, Becky, thanks for calling in. Good luck to you. And Joe, another thing we love here in Wisconsin is a fish fry, and this is something we'll do with local or ocean fish too. And that's another recipe you shared with us. We got a fried flounder at wpr.org/Food Friday. Tell us a little bit about your fried flounder recipe.
Well, you know, it's the fried flounder recipe is it's a typical recipe that would be used for fish and chips, pretty much that we would, and you know, I also have a recipe for fluke. On the East Coast, fluke and flounder are similar, and you could do the same. You could bread it with some wonder flour, which is a wonderful flour that doesn't clump. It'll never ever clump, and the fish would look just as perfect as that picture in the book does. It's it really takes 5 minutes to cook. What did you want to know about it, Ron?
Oh, just wanted the basics there. And when it comes to frying, I hadn't heard about that Wonder flour. Talk about, you know, temperature and things like that, because I have had fish fry gone wrong where I think the temperature, I don't know, it's too low or something. What are some things we got to be careful about when we're doing fish fry?
Okay, well, the fryer, I have a fryer. I have a mini fryer where I would fry shrimp and fry different items. But if you don't, you should get the oil to about 375. If you just, you know, like you're boiling water, you boil oil, but it should come up to about 375. And then, depending on the thickness, as I described in the book, it could take 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, depending on how thick. And in the book, I fry oysters, I fry clams, I fry different items, some shrimp. But there's all different variations. Every item is 30 seconds different than the other because you don't want to overcook it. That's the key, not overcooking it. And one of the things that that I've been trying to do, especially nowadays since we have the internet, I'm trying to sell fish to Middle America where they do not have had the opportunity to have saltwater fish, as you spoke of before. So anybody can get seafood delivered by 10:30 the next day by going to citarella.com.
Huh. That sounds great. I want to bring in another caller now. Bob is with us in Crivitz. And, Bob, hi. I understand you have a Wisconsin fish chowder recommendation for our earlier caller.
Oh, yes, I do. Yeah, thank you for letting me come on. Okay, I live in Wisconsin. I'm in northern Wisconsin. Okay, and I have made fish chowder out of, carp suckers, bluegills, crappies, northern pike, muskies, and then trout out of Lake Michigan, and salmon out of Lake Michigan. Any fish will work, just terrific.
And, Bob, it doesn't get, like Joe mentioned, that the fattier fish, like that salmon you mentioned, might get a little greasy in the chowder. Do you find that in yours?
I don't at all. Okay.
All right, Bob, thanks for sharing that chowder suggestion. He gives the thumbs up. We are talking to Joe Guerrera, author of the new book, Joe Knows Fish, Taking the Intimidation Out of Cooking Seafood. And, Joe, switching gears here, you answered a question I had, something I've gone wrong with before. If I'm cooking fish, sauteing it, whatever, I flip it again, and, of course, it's falling apart. You say one flip. Why is that?
It's very delicate. It's part of my rules. You know, you flip it once. On page 22, I have my rules, my seven rules, and one of them is being patient. And if you're grilling or sauteing, whatever you're doing, whatever the time is of the recipe, pay attention to it, stick to it, do it, and flip it only once. It is a delicate thing. Because once you keep on flipping it, it will fall apart.
And you've got a chapter devoted not to the fish and seafood themselves, it's a making your own classic seafood sauces. What are a couple of your favorite sauces that we might be able to try at home?
A dill sauce is a really good dipping sauce. It works for fish, and besides fish, it could work for raw vegetables also.
And what goes into that dill and what else?
You would use it as a crudité, and there's scallions and some parsley, some mayonnaise, sour cream, Dijon mustard, and some vinegar, and some spices and salt and pepper.
So pretty simple.
But it's very simple. Nothing that I do. This book is not recipe driven. I'm not, you know, I know how to cook. I'm not a chef, but I could cook seafood with the best of them. But again, it's very simple. I'm not giving you. It's not saucy. It's healthy, and it's great.
Now, you mentioned the issue of sustainability early on in the book and say that's important to you. Where can we go to find out, hey, this kind of fish is good when it comes to, you know, long-term health of the fish species?
You know, something like that, you'd have to trust your fishmonger to see that they're doing the right thing. You know, I sell wild fish and I sell farm fish. And I'll tell you right now, not that one is better than the other, but there are good farms and there are bad farms that don't take care of the merchandise the same way. Just the same way there's good chicken farms and there's not so good chicken farms. And there's a good doctor and a bad doctor. And there's a better carpenter and a lousy carpenter. So the same thing is applied. So you really have to trust your fishmonger. Hopefully that he chooses his sources, where he sources his fish is the right place.
Now we've got, I mentioned earlier, Joe, a lot of sports coming up this weekend. We got a UW Badgers game. The Brewers are still in the playoff chase here, the playoff games, I should say. And we got Packers mm-hmm. coming up Monday night, I think. What's a good fish that you'd make for, you know, getting people around the TV, maybe good finger food, nothing you have to, you know, fidget around with a lot with a fork and a plate?
I would, you know, steam mussels are great, but I don't know about you, for you guys, by you, that's the, again, we could ship it overnight, and mussels it's a good finger food. I would say even fried shrimp and fried calamari, fried squid, I think all of that is great.
All right, and I hope I'm not bringing up a sore subject, bringing up baseball right now for it to a New Yorker.
Well, I'm over it. I'm over it. We should have won game one, but we didn't. So, anyway, I'm over it.
All right. And, Joe, leave us with a pep talk for those people, you know, like I said, people who like to cook, but that fish, that, like you say, they're intimidated. Give us a pep talk to try it this weekend.
You know, I really think it's all about healthy eating. I think it's really give it a shot. It's you know, the book is available on Amazon, and it really is simple. I can't tell you how many people that I have converted, and they say, it's that easy? Are you serious? Is it that easy? I said, yeah, it's easy. You just have to pay attention. Like I said, don't answer your cell phone. Don't talk to anybody. Just do what you're doing for a couple of minutes and you'll be done.
All right. That's a great place to leave it. Joe, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've been talking to Joe Guerrera. He's the author of the new book, Joe Knows Fish, Taking the Intimidation Out of Seafood. He's the owner of Citarella Market in New York City. He joined us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about the best way to choose, prepare, and serve fish. You can still share your favorite fish dishes. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can check out those two recipes he shared. There's a flounder fish fry and that poached striped wild striped bass. We've got both of those recipes up at WPR.org/Food Friday. We gave you the basics of the recipes there, but you can get the full details again online, WPR.org/Food Friday. You can use a music playlist to liven up a party, give a little boost to your workout, or keep you entertained on a long drive. You can also use a playlist to save a life. In Red Cross CPR training, they teach you to do chest compressions at the rate of 100 beats per minute. When I took a class, and I think this is pretty common, they said use the song Staying Alive as the beat that clocks in at the right tempo. But that's not everybody's jam. Now, the New York Presbyterian Hospital has gone online with their own Spotify playlist of songs that will give you the right tempo for CPR chest compressions. Artists like Michael Jackson, the Doors, Notorious B.I.G., and many more make appearances on the 47-song playlist. To illustrate and to see if I still remember how to edit audio, I put together this little montage.
We don't
Here comes the big finish. Find that playlist on Spotify. This is Central Time.